It's 2003. The fight for the Formula One World Championship is between three drivers. Ferrari's Michael Schumacher, McLaren's Kimi Raikkonen, and Williams's Juan Pablo Montoya.
For the first time in 20 years, Williams wins at Monaco. Juan Montoya wins at Monaco. A memorable, memorable day for everybody in the Williams BMW team, and particularly for Juan Pablo Montoya.
Only the best win at Monaco, and Montoya was one of the very best. In that 2003 season, two victories and a string of podiums put him in title contention. Schumacher, Raikkonen, Alonso, Villeneuve, Coulthard, Barrichello, Fisichella, on his day, Juan Pablo could beat them all. He didn't win the world championship his speed and competitive spirit surely deserved.
I don't know, I relied on myself a lot, more than on other people. Like, I'm going to prove everybody wrong. For me, probably that was the biggest drive. The way I looked at it is, if you can do it, I can do it better.
Hello, I'm Tom Clarkson, and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. This is the first of our Legends episodes, where I catch up with some of the greatest drivers ever to race in Formula One. We look back at their very best moments and ask them what they'd do differently if they had the chance, and get their views on Formula One today. Juan Pablo Montoya is definitely a legend, at home in Colombia and around the world. A year after winning the Indy 500 at the first attempt, he burst into Formula One with Williams in 2001 and took victory in his rookie season. The V10 BMW-powered Williamses were among the best on the grid, and Montoya used them to good effect, putting himself and the team in the fight for championships. They came closest in 2003, and that's what I spoke to Juan Pablo about when we sat down in Australia. He reflects on how he approached that season, how he dealt with being in the title fight, and whether trying too hard may have actually harmed his chances.
Something that happens in this sport, the effort you put in doesn't match the result you get, sadly enough. Because there's years that you work your butt off. And sometimes when you're trying harder, it's harder to get better things. And sometimes when you relax, you actually perform better.
We also talked about Juan Pablo's off-track relationships with rivals like Michael Schumacher, what made him push himself to the limits, and how he's supporting his son Sebastian, who's now racing in Formula 3. In fact, Sebastian pops in to join us towards the end of the conversation. It was great to speak to both racing Montoyas together. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with an F1 legend. Juan Pablo Montoya, great to have you back on the show. How are you?
Yeah, good. How are you doing?
I'm very, very well. Now, JPM, you've been on the show before. So I want... You have, yeah. But 6 years ago, I agree. It feels like an age. But this time...
So you're still around.
Yeah, yes. Same to you, right? It was...
No, I haven't.
You've been doing Indy and all sorts.
NASCAR and you name it.
You've been a busy boy. But I wanted to focus this episode on 2003, because it was your most successful season in Formula One. You finished third in the World Championship, as you had done the previous year, but you scored a bunch more points. You scored a couple of wins as well. What are your abiding memories of that year?
I think probably the highlight is Indy, when Rubens had the broken gearbox and I went to pass him and I was inside and he turned into me and he spun off and I got a penalty for it. I'm like, oh, there you go.
And it still riles with you now, right?
No, but like that's really... in a crazy way, it sucked because it got me out of the championship. But then we went to the last race and I was leading and the engine blew up.
Yeah.
So I would have lost the championship. You know what I mean? That would have hurt even
more.
Well,
and that cost Williams the Constructors' Championship as well, I think, at that blowout in Japan.
So you're the numbers guy. I don't know.
JPM, how much pressure was there on Williams going into the year? Because the team had finished second in the Constructors' Championship the year before. What were Frank and Patrick like? What was the message for you and Ralf Schumacher, your teammate?
Nothing. Like, honestly, we...
Did you feel pressure?
No. You're there to do a job. You know what you need to do. I think 03 was very special because the amount of development went through the year in the car. I don't think the car was as good as it needed to be at the beginning of the year, but the amount of evolution we had through the year was unbelievable. And I think that's what made the car so good, is the amount of development through the year.
I mean, what was the high point for the FW26 as it was? What was it best at?
I think the amount of how you could roll through the middle of the corner, like everywhere, like how much speed you could roll in and how good the car was. It's kind of funny because we go, for example, now that I'm coming in a lot of races with my kid, and you hear, the car is unstable and the car is doing this and the car is doing that and rear locking and all this. I keep telling him, it's like, you know, once you get here, all that things go away. I know, like, Ollie Berman raced against him quite a bit. You know, they went at it for the F4 Championship a few years back. And I was talking to Ollie a couple of days ago here in Australia, and I said, was it much easier to drive, wasn't it? He said, yes. It's like, you spend all these years preparing with the cars that are a freaking handful, and you get into this car that you're pretty much the limit. The car just does everything right. And the smaller teams don't understand how different it is.
What about the power and the engine?
BMW that year was on fire.
You had the best engine on the grid, would you say?
Yeah, I think 03 we had the best engine. I think 04 we were there, but I think Honda was maybe a little better.
I remember you praising the drivability as well.
Yeah, it was a really good engine. We were, and the electronics and everything. Like, it's hard because beating Ferrari in those years was like what Red Bull's today. It was nearly impossible. And realistically, you could beat them when Michelin brought a better tire. But when the tires were even, I think Ferrari still had a better car than us.
Did you relish the tire war that was going on at the time?
It was really cool, yeah. It was really cool, the amount of testing we did, the amount of running we did. It was a different world. You know what I mean? Nowadays, they don't do any running. I think it's nicer, the amount of races they do now. And it's funny because everybody complains about it. They're too many, but they're really not too many. Yes, there are more races that traditionally 15 races or 16 races a year, but personally, I'd rather be doing 10 more races in my time than 100 days of testing by myself in somewhere.
Although there were only 16 races back then, I'll bet you did more days in a racing car than they currently do now because of the testing.
Oh yeah, we used to race Friday, Saturday, Sunday, like race weekend, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of the next week, we were in the car. And then the week after, like Monday and Tuesday, we're doing sim, and then race weekend again. And that was kind of our way of going about it. And precision testing, we used to do, 15, 20 days of testing before the first race? And then end of the season was the same thing. You know, we used to take, I think the rules was December 10 to January 5th or something, that it was the no driving. It was like 3 weeks or something. And that was it.
Get you fit.
Yeah, you are so much in the car. I mean, when you're doing 400, 500 Ks a day in the car testing and the race is 300, it's like, is that it?
Look, just while we're setting the scene for the championship, right? There's two more things I wanted to ask you about. One was the introduction of the hands device.
Yes.
The head and neck restraint. Now, I remember you being quite vocal about that.
I freaking hated it.
Saying it was really uncomfortable.
It was really uncomfortable.
But did you ever get on top of it?
Yeah. It's kind of funny because this was 2002, and they said, we're going to run it next year. I'm going, I really don't want to do this. And I had to get into a spare car somewhere. And I don't know what happened with the hands, and I couldn't fit with the hands. There was something without the hands that I had to do an install lap or something without the hands, and it fails. And it was funny because I remember the engineers telling me, be really careful, you don't have a hands. And I'm thinking, dude, I've raced all my life without a hands. It's not, you know what I mean? This is not different than 12, 6 months ago, or you know what I mean? And it was really funny, and it felt really insecure without the hands.
And that happened very quickly
in your mind. The problem is the first hands were so uncomfortable. The shape was wrong. The padding was awful. Like nowadays you have like gel pads and you have like, oh, they're so nice.
And if you have been racing recently, you would feel, it would feel wrong to be doing it without the hands.
I mean, yeah. I've raced with the hands device for the past 20 years.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I wouldn't really get in a race car without a hands device.
Yeah. Other thing I wanted to ask you about was one lap qualifying. That was introduced in 2003. Did you like the pressure of that, being out on the track on your own?
Yeah, it was weird. And I did well at it, but it was, for me, the four laps were the best. When they used to call it 12 laps, the four lap qualifying for me, it was so good because you could build on it. So the way I always looked at it is, okay, lap one, let's match what we did in practice. If you can match what you did in practice or even a little better because you got to take less fuel, you started really well. Because so if the first run you're on par with practice, it means from now on, whatever you do, it's a plus. And if you already did this, it means you, like if you had a car for the pole, that first lap was good enough maybe for 6, 7, 8 place. So it means even if I throw the car off now, I'm starting in a decent place.
So it's a bit of a comfort blanket for you.
Yeah. So every time you did a lap faster, it was better. And I remember my engineer used to tell me, and even the mechanics, when we were going out, like in like 2002, when I got all those poles, they used to tell me at the end of qualifying, they go, like when it was closed, they would come to me and say, either bring it P1 or bring it in a truck. Yeah. Like we don't care fixing the car. Just go for it.
How does that help you mentally?
It's really comfortable because a lot of people and mechanics get really moody when you crash a car. And then you start feeling, oh, I don't want to do that. You know what I mean? And when in your mind crashing the car is irrelevant, you normally don't crash it because you're not thinking about it. And you're so comfortable. So basically the way I looked at it in qualifying, anywhere where the car didn't move, it means it could go quicker. And that was the mentality. It's like if I braked and between finishing the brake and getting on the gas, I had space, it means I needed to brake later. Because you can't really get any earlier on the gas because you need to do the corner. But if you had to wait, like brake and roll, oh, you can go 5, 10 meters later on the brakes.
So you loved walking the tightrope, driving that tightrope.
And in high speed, if you went and the car didn't freaking tail slap or anything, it means you could go quicker.
Juan Pablo, I think a lot of people watching and listening to this think of you as this feisty racer on a Sunday. But actually hearing you talk about qualifying like this makes me think, actually, was qualifying the bit that you enjoyed the most?
The thing in my time, the races were qualifying. We qualified every lap. One of the coolest experiences I had in F1 is when I started doing all the testing with Michelin. And I came from IndyCar where you had to, manage the tires a little bit, not like today, but you couldn't beat the tires of the car. So I went and then I remember I went like really good lap. Okay. And then it backed off and then it got better and better, like just managing the pace. And I stopped and they said, is the tire coming back? I said, no, I'm just managing. And they got mad at me. And they go, no, we need you to qualify every lap. We need you to destroy the tire. Like you did that first lap, do all 5 laps like that first lap. Even if you're 3 seconds off, please destroy the tire. And
different mentality today.
Yes, because the way they're thinking is, we need to see what's the failure of the tire, where is the fatigue of the tire, what do we need to work on to make it better? And I'll give you the best example. And I was just getting started, but my first race here, I remember I was running and I had Panis in front of me. And in my mind, I'm going, I should be able to beat Panis. You know what I mean? Nothing against him. He's really good. You know, I mean, he's done hell, he won Monaco, everything. But in my mind, I'm thinking, I gotta beat Panis. And he's in front of me and I'm running, I think P6 and I'm in the points and I'm going, oh my God, he's driving away from me. So I push harder. Okay, still a little, and I push harder and I keep pushing and I'm like qualifying every lap. I go to a point now, I'm thinking I'm pushing harder right now that I did in qualifying. I'm like every lap. And I finally started like taking a tenth away from him and I'm catching him. I'm all excited. And then the engine blew up. But then I realized it's like, oh my God, you need to drive so fast the whole time. There were tracks where you never needed to manage the tires. There were other tracks where you had to. But there it was like, oh my God. And it was really cool. It's a different experience. It's like, we had so little deg that as the fuel burned down, we used to go quicker. You know, our pace got quicker, not slower.
You loved that, didn't you?
Yeah, because you're like, and they would come on the radio. I'm like, Juan, we need a couple more tens. And you like somehow figure out how to go quicker. Like you're pushing to the limit and then they go, we need more. And you go, where the hell am I going to find more? And then you go, I think I can throw it in a little faster here. And you try it. And sometimes you screw up and shunt to the car.
When you're hiring, it feels amazing to finally close out a job search. But what if you could get rid of the search and just match? Well, you can with Indeed. Indeed is not just a job board, it's your ultimate matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it's on hand to help you streamline your hiring processes and connect with quality candidates faster. There's no need to manually filter through hundreds of applications anymore because Indeed does the hard work for you by matching you with the right people for the job from the start. And what I think is great is that you can then schedule, screen, and message candidates all from one place. It makes a usually difficult and time-consuming task so much easier. And better yet, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. In fact, according to a recent Indeed survey, 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. So whether you're a small business or a big corporation, Indeed has you covered. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide who trust Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/grid. Just go to Indeed.com/grid right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/grid. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. What about your rivals at that time? I wanted to ask you, first of all, about your teammate, Ralf Schumacher. What were his greatest strengths?
Honestly, Ralf was so, so good.
Where? What made him
his
so
speed.
Good? Raw speed.
Oh my God, he was so quick. He played with me for so long. It was so annoying. It was so hard. It was so hard. And like the things he could do with the car in one lap pace, it was unreal. Like it was really unreal. And it was so annoying and so frustrating to not be able to match him at the beginning.
So do you think he hasn't got the credibility that he deserves?
You know what's the problem is I destroy him mentally.
How? Go on. Were you playing mind games the whole, even when you were outside the car, right?
But we never really talk. So nowadays with social media and everything, the teammates are best friends and they go for dinner together and they all go play paddle together. In my time, you didn't talk to anybody. You know, I used to talk to Fernando and still do, and Rubens and Massa sometimes, and that was it.
So the paddock was a more hostile environment.
It was very hostile. It was you didn't talk to anybody. And honestly, from my IndyCar days, and even from back there, I think Ganassi had probably one of the best lines ever. It said, I was nice to somebody, a driver somewhere, and I wasn't cutthroat when I raced him. And he got pissed at me. I said, if you want friends, bring them. You're not here to make friends.
That's a good line. Yeah.
And it's true. Nowadays, with the social media, everybody talks, everybody's nice and everything. But when you're that nice, it's hard to be an asshole. And it's hard to pull a move where you're going to drive the other guy off the track when you like the guy.
Do you know, when the visor comes down, does that not blank everything else out?
Yeah, but if it's the guy you had dinner with last night, it's a lot harder to go and throw the car and... Yeah, I mean, you're going to race him hard, but you might, you know what I mean? It's not as cutthroat. But nowadays, the rules are a little more that you can be that extreme, where in my time, you could just drive him on a friggin' racetrack.
Well, look, that leads me on to my next topic, which is Michael Schumacher. He had won the previous three world titles going to that. Did you treat him differently on the track? Tell us now, because I've got a list in front of me. Of all of the, well, some of the incidents you guys had, I'm thinking in the tunnel in Monaco 2004, Imola 2004 at Tosa,
And look at Montoya. He's really attacking Michael Schumacher as they go down towards Villeneuve. He wants through. He wants through. No, he can't get through.
Schumacher and Montoya too busy watching each other. Schumacher pushes Montoya clean off the road.
What an explosive start to the Grand Prix. Incredible side-by-side action. The two Williams is there on the grass, but Schumacher and Montoya, that was incredible going through the Tosa corner.
You know, you gotta either be blind or stupid to not see me, but, you know, it's racing.
I think you were trying to go around the outside and you said afterwards he's either blind. Well, what did you say? He's blind or stupid?
Yeah, blind
or
stupid. So the Tosa one is they were quicker than us, but we were really quick on fresh tires. Our tires, when they were new, they were really good. So if I had to pass him, I had to go straight away. And I got there, and honestly, I was okay. He drove me off the track, and I would have done the same thing. Like, I was okay with it. I tried. Like, on my side, I'm going to try. But he drove me off the track, so I'm going to, you know what I mean? And if he would have done in the interview, and they asked him what happened, I said, I just drove him off the track. I would have been okay with it. But he said, I just didn't see him. You know what I mean? He played right into it.
Yeah. And you were sat ready to
I'm just, like, everybody thinks and talks. I talked and think. And I end up surprising myself as much as everybody around me.
But back to my original question. Were you harder on Michael than you were other drivers?
What was
because he
with
was
Michael
Schumacher.
No, the annoying thing with Michael is nobody raced him. When Michael was coming from the back, it's like, oh, Michael's coming. Everybody would get out away from him. That pissed me off. Because it's like, why? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's Michael. Don't fuck with Michael.
Do you think it was that, or do you think it was the fact he was in a Ferrari that was so much quicker than...
No, but everybody has so much respect.
So he's got them beat before he even puts his helmet
on. Yes. And kind of my approach with racing was, I was such an asshole racing, and people thought I was so crazy that it worked. Because when I throw the car in, they knew I was going, and I wasn't going to get out of the way. So you had two choices. You either give me room or we crashed.
Well, and that's what happened at Interlagos in 2001.
Yeah.
First season for you.
Yeah. Let's say yes. The short version.
So with all of these incidents, Juan, you say you didn't talk to other drivers. When you've had an incident with Michael, whether it's a race-ending incident or an overtake, would you discuss it?
No. The only time I talked to Michael, I was racing for BMW and he was still a Ferrari. And Norbert Hogg invited us to a party in Nürburgring after the race. And I said yes, because we had her staying there for the night. I went there because Norbert invited me, and it was Michael and Rubens, and the three of us got drunk, and that was it.
Can you remember what was said? Or
Was it
easy between you? Because I think for all of the differences between most of you racing drivers, there are huge similarities because you've all lived the same life. You've got the same sacrifices to get to the top. There are so many. You're almost so similar.
I'll give you an example. Like, you know the relationship I had with Villeneuve when we raced. Like, it was cutthroat. You know what I mean? We hated each other. And when I started coming back to the races, we looked at each other and we just laughed about it.
Right.
And that was
it. I think
it.
That's my point, right?
Yeah, but at the point, we nearly punch each other in the driver's meeting in Canada.
But I also think you were a wind-up merchant, right? I suppose it's the mind games thing you were telling me about.
Yeah, but like,
you knew
like,
what buttons to press.
Like in Canada, I got in his way and he wasn't like, it was one of those things that I don't know if I was doing an install. It was the first run. I was in an outlap and he was coming. I didn't see him and I got in his way. And he got next to me, threw the car at me. Kind of went, and I went, and he brake tested me, and I said, fuck it, I didn't brake. I ran into the back of him, and actually really hard, and he went, and the rear suspension fell, and he had a massive shunt. And then he blamed me for the shunt. And I'm like, screw you.
I see a glint in your eye. There's a glint
of course I enjoyed it. Yeah, of course. If you're another driver, and you look at that, and I'm behind you, and I throw the car in, what do you think they're going to think? Oh, just go. I don't want to have a problem. I don't want to crash.
So the two wins, 2003. First one comes at Monaco.
Yeah.
And Michelin.
We should have won Austria before and the engine. We were leading and the engine blew up.
It seems that BMW were right on the limit.
Well, they were all on the limit. Like, the problem is nowadays they go, oh my God, the gearbox failed. The engine failed. And it's a big drama.
For a driver, was it easy to accept? Oh, I've had an engine failure, but we're all pushing to the limit. These things happen.
Like, it was part of the culture. You know what I mean? At the beginning, you go, oh, my God, but it's okay.
So Monaco, Michelin turn up with a slightly wider front tire. Was that the secret that allowed you to win that race?
No, because the guys we were fighting mainly were in Michelins as well. So I think that didn't really change.
Well, Raikkonen was half a second behind you lap after lap.
We were going, I think, at like 16,000 RPM because we had no oil. They were actually surprised we made it to the end of the race. Like the last five laps, I was going, like short shifting like crazy. You know, 20,000 RPM and you're 19.5 or whatever. We're going, like, think about your road car that it goes to 7,000. You're shifting at 4,000. Like, you're not using any power.
Did you think you weren't going to get to the end of the race?
I didn't know how bad the oil situation was. But they said, we need to do this or we're not going to make it. I'm okay. And I just drove as slow as I could. I think we had enough pace to drive away pretty easily.
For the first time in 20 years, Williams wins at Monaco. Juan Montoya wins at Monaco. A memorable, memorable day for everybody in the Williams BMW team, and particularly for Juan Pablo Montoya.
So, Juan Pablo, what was it like to win Monaco? I mean, the team hadn't won that race since, I think, 1983 with Keke Rosberg. The jewel in the crown, it's described. What does it mean to you?
So for me, that's probably that and with the Indy 500 wins, especially the second one, probably the biggest wins for me because I grew up watching Senna and Senna was all about Monaco, you know what I mean? And in my time, that was the only street course. The only time you went to a street race was Monaco. So that was in itself was really cool. So, you know, it's the only time in the year you took a Formula One car to a street course. And I think that's really cool. Like, for example, F3, the only street course they do is Monaco. And I think that's really nice.
It makes it unique, even more unique if you can say exactly. Such a thing. The other win came at Hockenheim. And you were utterly dominant that weekend.
Yeah, and we only had 80%
win,
throttle.
Fastest lap.
Like, I remember I got into the stadium and the thing shut down and it came back. And we had less power, and they said, yeah, I just managed it to the end. And funny enough, we really only had 80% throttle, and we nearly lapped the field. But I think part of their being so fast is there was a shunt in turn one that made the race easier. And I was on a three-stop race, and most of them were in a two-stop, and the deck was a little high that so made a huge difference.
What is it like to dominate a weekend like that?
I don't know. It's what you're meant to do. Something that it was different then than now, with the tire war and everything, that it was not only you that were competitive. So when we were competitive, McLaren was competitive, or BAR were competitive, or Renault was competitive. Where in the other side, when Ferrari was competitive, was Ferrari, I think, what was the other team? Minardi? We were only two teams on the other tire. So for us was harder. And the other thing that was hard is Michelin had to build a tire to make three or four teams happy. And everybody's asking for different things. Like, we're asking for traction and McLaren is asking for front end.
So what do they do?
They kind of, I think you could pick different tires.
The job list was just longer for them than it was for...
Yeah, exactly. And there were weeks where you had to compromise a little bit and weeks where they had to compromise a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was good. It was. I enjoyed it. For me, it was really cool because it was just... You know what I mean? Always finding ways to make the car better. For me, the technical side of the driving was really cool. Like making the car better and figure out how to make the car better. That for me was probably the coolest thing about the racing.
Hockenheim was mid-season. At that point, you've just dominated that weekend. What were you thinking about the championship?
I wasn't. I never did.
Really?
No, I never did because with the Ferrari and the Bridgestone, every time they got better, then... they would just go out and do what I did. But instead of doing it one time a year like I did, they used to do it 7-8 times a year.
Because after the early season flyaways, Schumacher was back in, I think, P6 in the championship. He had a very slow start. Okay, you'd had, you know, the Austria blow up and some unfortunate things. But I felt you had momentum at that time.
Yeah, we did. But I don't, I mean, you take it race by race and you see what happens. But again... you don't know how the development is and how everything goes. And even with everything that happened, we were looking pretty decent. But I don't like counting my eggs before. You know what I mean? It's like you need to focus on the job in hand. And the job in hand is the easiest way to win a championship is to win races.
I did want to talk to you about Monza 03, scene of your first win, of course, a couple of years earlier. But Ralf Schumacher didn't do that race because he'd had a crash at the Lesmo in testing and he was suffering a bit. So Pisonia comes in. How much did it affect you having a different, inexperienced wingman?
Nothing. Nothing, because we never shared anything. There was so little interaction between the two cars. And we did so much testing anyway. What you didn't figure out, you didn't figure out. You don't need a teammate to figure it out. You know what I mean? I don't know. I relied on myself a lot more than on other people.
You know, you said that you and Jacques Villeneuve laughed when you first hooked up. And I guess you chat quite a lot now in the paddock together. What about when you and Ralf see each other now?
So with Ralf, it was funny because when I went to McLaren and he went to Toyota, we looked at each other and we just laughed.
Is there anything that you could have done differently in 2003 that would have somehow changed the end result?
Not really.
Do you feel it was, in terms of the seasons you did in Formula One, do you feel it was a good one?
I think it was as good as 04 or 02, you know what I mean? It's the result, something that happens in this sport, the effort you put in doesn't match the result you get, sadly enough. Because there's years that you work your butt off and you do everything by the book and you get to the race and you have shitty races. Somebody runs over you, you go off, you make a mistake in qualifying, you do this. And sometimes when you're trying harder, it's harder to get better things. And sometimes when you relax and you let things come to you, you actually perform better.
Sounds like golf.
Yeah, it's the same thing, you know what I mean?
The harder you try with golf, the worse.
It's like if somebody tells you, don't crash the car, you can tell, you know what I mean, to tell them to screw off, but in the back of your mind, you're still thinking about it. You know what I mean? So sometimes being relaxed about it and letting it happen, have a little more self-belief and just like, I'm going to prove everybody wrong. For me, probably that was the biggest drive. The way I looked at it is, if you can do it, I can do it better. I don't think I'm better than you. I never felt myself better than anybody, but they said, oh, like a Rouge 2002, a Rouge before they repaved, I went flat through a Rouge before in the morning because it rained in qualifying. I went flat the last lap of practice. It's going to have to be flat somehow. I might as well just get it out of the system. And I tried it. And I did it flat.
Seems to me that one of your greatest qualities was your competitiveness. You just love competition. Am I right?
Yes. Ask him.
Well, in fact, let's bring him in. So him is son Sebastian.
Am I competitive?
No. Not at all.
He's the same.
No, Sebastian, this is, I feel, history repeating itself because, of course, you're now racing in Formula 3. We're speaking in Melbourne, scene of your podium last year. Was there ever any doubt in your mind that you were going to be a racing driver?
Yes. When I was very, very, very young, I remember that when we would go to Colombia, I used to ride like dirt bikes and stuff. And when they got me the go-kart, I would think to myself, like, why would I want to do karting? That's too slow. Like, my motocross is quicker. Like, why would I? And then they gave me a bigger go-kart and I went, this is nice. And then they gave me a faster one and this is nice. And then a faster one and I went, yeah, this is it.
So the first love was two wheels.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because we gave him a baby kart, but we limit the hell out of it because, you know, he's like 3 or 4 years old. And, you know, I mean, you don't want him to go and hit his head into the steering wheel or, you know what I mean? It's a little track. So we limited where he could go pretty much flat out and just go. And if he crashed, and he didn't enjoy it too much. He wasn't too keen. And then back home in Colombia, you know, we gave him some kid squats and things. And I think that's where it came from. And then once he got old enough where we felt he could drive without injuring himself, then we turned it up.
you got more power under your right foot. But Sebastian, tell us a little bit about your career so far. I mean, Juan Pablo talked about Formula 4, but just a very quick resume so we know what you've done so far.
Yeah, so I did 2 years in Formula 4. Funny enough, the 2 years I raced with Oli, it was quite fun. Then I did 1 year in Formula Regional European Championship. And the past 2 years I've been racing in Formula 3.
And what is it like having a dad who's been there, done it?
It's really good, obviously, because he knows a lot. It's very annoying because he knows a lot, so he's right. Like, I think that was something really difficult at the beginning, like, because our relationship was father and son. And then when I started going through karting, it was, my dad's really annoying. Like, just like, come on, like, calm down there. Like, I don't, like, you're not that good. And then you just kind of go, well, maybe he is that good. If he's won a couple races, like, I think he's decent. You just start to realize, and especially as I've grown up, I think the biggest, like, moment that I went, yeah, he's good, is we were racing in Watkins Glen, because we did a couple endurance races together, and we were racing in Watkins Glen, and in practice I was a bit quicker than him. And then I remember we got into the race and the fastest lap was his. And then I just started pushing and pushing and pushing. And in F3, F4 in regional, you have to manage the tires, just like F1. And with the Michelins that they had in endurance racing, there was no managing. So I was pushing and pushing and pushing. And I remember there's only been two times in my life where I go, this is sketchy. This is on the edge. And one of them was racing Macau last year. And then the other one was in Watkins Glen, where I did a carousel flat. I break to the next corner and I didn't even turn the steering wheel. I was doing like 220, something like that. And the car is rotating by itself. And I'm saying, oh, this is good. I come out of the corner and I'm a tenth and a half quicker. And I'm like, this is it.
Juan Pablo, you've done so much racing in your career. How special were those sports car races that you did with Sebas?
It was really cool. I think we had probably more fun doing it in America than ELMS. The way the rules are, personally, I think it's better. So the races in America were, you know, the ones we did together were a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun as well doing ELMS, but it was, I think, a little different.
And how useful is it for you with your data bank? You've had the career. You know where the potholes are. How does that help Sebas?
Well, it helps a lot with the team, understanding what he needs, what we're missing and everything. But I think a good example is last year, I saw Andrea Stella. And we were talking about, you know, how things and, you know, talk about tire management and things to do and la, 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 la. You know, last year he was a junior driver with Red Bull. So I said, you know, I mean, he wanted to help. I said, no, it's okay. Thank you. Yes, but I never really pursued it. And this year, you know, he's still with Red Bull, but as an athlete, not under the junior program. So I thought, you know, I saw Andrea in Bahrain and we, you know, I watch a lot of the practices and things in the McLaren garage. And we were talking about it. Actually, this morning we were with Andrea this morning talking about, you know, things to do. I think it's good for him to see not only what I think and what my point of view, but a guy like Stella that, I mean, see what he done with McLaren. It's unbelievable. Somebody like him to be able to give some advice to Sebas about it, I think it was really cool. I think we have a really good relationship now. And we understand each other and we work really well together and we have a really good relationship. But I think sometimes it's still good to hear from somebody else.
How difficult is it for you to sometimes hang back and not tell him exactly what you're thinking? Or do you?
I do tell him what I think. When he does well, I don't tell him as much as when he does bad.
School of hard knocks.
Yeah.
Do you get nervous watching him?
It sucks, yeah. It's so much better being a driver. It's a cool experience, you know what I mean? But as a, you know what I mean, the dad side, it's kind of hard, but you got to be there in the good and the bad and in the evil. We went, for example, this year to Bahrain to do the precision testing and he was sick. In 3 days, he did, what, 15 laps in 3 days? We did a 12-lap long run and a couple of short runs, but he was so sick, we didn't do anything. We didn't learn anything. And then you get to the race weekend when everybody did full 3 days of testing. We haven't done anything and you do one lap in practice. And it's tough because, so what they had all the reference they thought they needed, none of them work and you go wide and you miss the corners in that single lap. Next you go out to qualify. It's like, so where do you start? You know what I mean? And you only got three goes at it and it makes it really hard.
And Sebas, do you feel you've made up for that now? That lack of running in testing, do you feel you're now back up to speed compared to your rivals?
Yeah, I think something quite good is since it's the second year, I have the experience. So I can back that up with the experience from last year. But even switching teams, because last year I was with Hi-Tech, this year I'm with Campo. So learning the car and how you have to drive it, obviously it's quite difficult. Like as my dad said, 3 days of testing doesn't sound a lot. But in F3, when you have one practice that you do a lap, it makes a big difference.
What is the plan? So it's F3 now. Have you got it mapped out in your head what the next few seasons look like? Or is it not possible to do that in motor racing?
it's quite difficult because I have the best example is Ollie a couple weeks ago. He was racing F2, pulled it in F2, and then congrats in Bahrain, you didn't score any points, you got your pole position, but now you're not racing F2, you're racing F1. So I think it's really difficult to exactly plan out how everything goes. I think Oscar as well, for example, he's a really good example that he won everything until Formula 2 and then you're out. Like nowadays, it's really hard to plan exactly what you're going to do. But for me, the goal is Formula 1. And this is my second year in F3. I'm going to be fighting for the championship. That's my hope. I'm going to be fighting for wins. And that's the plan I have. Next year, Formula 2 and see what happens after that.
What's the best bit of advice that the old man's given you?
Enjoy it. You put so much work into it and stuff that sometimes you forget to enjoy it. Like, for example, like Bahrain, like I worked all winter, like for those 3 days where you just work every single day. You go to the gym, get all the reps in, go on the runs, like those bad days when you don't want to get out of bed and you do it just for those 3 days, you're ill and you do 12 laps. You just kind of go, you have to be kidding me, really? And something in Bahrain that I realized is I have an amazing opportunity. I'm racing F3. I'm really fast. The speed's okay. It's just one of those things where you just kind of have to step back and realize all the work you've done and where you are now and just kind of go, not too bad. It's not too bad. And it's quite nice.
Well, look, best of luck. Can I just have the old man back now, just very quickly? JPM, we always end these now with some quick fire questions that wanted to throw at you, okay? I ask the same to everybody. What else are you good at?
A lot of stuff.
No, I'm serious. Things with coordination, physics, stuff like that. I don't know. I just catch things really easy.
Sebas, what else is he good at?
Golf.
Really?
When I left NASCAR, I was a 2 handicap, 1.7 or something index.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's decent.
This year, we haven't played because of the weather in Europe. But last year, at the end of last year, I was a 6.6 index.
Okay. Respect. Decent. Which racing driver, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
A race car driver stuck with a lift with? Probably Senna. Because he's the only guy I looked up to. He would probably hate it because I would be really annoying, but yeah.
Who would play you in a film?
Kevin Hart, about the same height.
He's funny. JPM, who is the coolest person in your address book?
I don't know. Let's say, oh yeah, J Balvin, probably. Balvin, the singer, he spends a lot of time with Lewis, comes to a lot of F1 races and is always on the grid and stuff. It's huge.
He's in your address book.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because a lot of his friends are big fans, so a lot of times we do video calls and stuff. It's kind of funny.
Final one. Who would be your first guest if you hosted a podcast?
If I wanted to get the attention of people, probably Ralph.
I would watch that.
You see?
So good to catch up with you again. Thank you for your time. Sebas, good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Who wouldn't want to hear a Juan Pablo and Ralph Schumacher podcast? Shall I see if I can make that happen? But what a great chat. Juan Pablo's memories of that golden era of Formula One are vivid and remain unfiltered and untarnished. There were many highlights, but I especially enjoyed hearing about his relationship with Michael Schumacher. There was an intensity between them that has rarely been repeated in the sport. Thanks for your time, JPM. It was great to have you on the show again. And please let me know your thoughts on what Juan Pablo had to say and tell me which other F1 legends you'd like to hear from. And talking of thoughts and messages, many of you enjoyed hearing from Ayo Komatsu last week. Ayo has such a fascinating backstory, doesn't he? Adrian King got in touch to say this. This was one of the very best interviews the pod has ever produced. What a thoughtful and engaging man. I wish Ayo well for the future. Thank you for sharing with us, Tom. Well, thanks for getting in touch, Adrian. That is a lovely note, and we received many more like that. Well, that's almost it for this week. Remember that you can watch highlights of Juan Pablo's races with Williams and McLaren on F1 TV and on the Formula One YouTube channel. And while you're on YouTube, check out the other video episodes of F1 Beyond the Grid, including Oscar Piastri, Sergio Perez, and Alex Albon. I'll be back next week with another big name from the world of Formula One. In the meantime, thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.